No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law.
Greetings, and welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, your guide to the legal intricacies behind the contract and fiscal laws that power the U.S. Army and the Department of Defense. I am Major Sarah Hickman.
And I am Major Daniel Frankel. Together, we are your co-hosts.
On this episode of The Far and Beyond, we will talk with Colonel Jose Cora about his career and the contract and fiscal law opportunities in the U.S. Army JAG Corps. Colonel Cora is an attorney in the Judge Advocate General's Corps and an expert in the Government Acquisitions and Appropriations Law.
At the time of the recording, he was currently serving as the Chief of the Contract Litigation and Intellectual Property Division, U.S. Army Legal Services Agency. Colonel Cora will soon be retiring after 33 years of service and will be starting his new position as the General Counsel of the Defense Logistics Agency. Colonel Cora's complete bio will be on the show notes.
Sir Colonel Cora, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Sir, can you share your journey into contract and fiscal law? Are there any unexpected turns?
I think there were two major unexpected things that happened during my career, coming into contract and then one in fiscal law, and then when I got to the field and everything else. So, but I think that the good preface is starting my journey into contract and fiscal. So I was an MP as a military policeman, and then the Army has a program called the Funded Legal Education Program, where they basically pay to send you to law school. They pay for the law school, and they also, it's actually your duty. So you get paid your salary as you're going to law school. So they're basically paying you to go to law school. Great deal if you can get it. So understand my mindset coming into law school. I was an MP where I'd been arresting the people that were suspected of committing crimes. And the way I looked at it was, I'm going to go to law school, and then I'm going to be Perry Mason, and I'm going to take these criminals that I just arrested, and I'm going to put them away for good. And so I went to law school. In law school, my best grade in law school was criminal law, and my worst grade in law school was
contract
law. That was my word, because I didn't care anything about contract law. I didn't think I would ever see it in my life, and I didn't care how I did in that class. That was my worst grade. And it was, a little bit complex, and I had some math and everything, so didn't like it. So graduate from law school, I joined the Army. I do, the typical jobs and everything, and then I start doing, and I go do military justice. And I did fine as a trial counsel, and I did fine at it. But after doing it, I knew I do not want to do that for the rest of my life. I did not know what I wanted to do, but I knew I did not want to do crim law for the rest of my life. It was just not a good fit for a lot of different reasons for me and everything. So I started doing some other stuff. I tried claims. I tried to do a bunch of other stuff. And then I got the opportunity to deploy with the Joint Logistics Command to Afghanistan in 2005. And as you can imagine, the Joint Logistics Command, the logistics unit, has a lot of contract and fiscal that is involved. And that's where I actually got my initial exposure to contract and fiscal law. I saw how important the contract fiscal law was in for the effort. Not only could I see it, I could tell my bosses, my commanders, that was the most important thing to them, because as we know, 10% of soldiers are going to give you 90% of problems. We were going to have night court, which is where, the commanders come in and give Article 15s for one day a week to everybody that's up for that and everything else. And it was just all pro forma. Yeah, we got to do that. But what got my commanders really excited was when I was able to bring resources, contract and fiscal resources, to bear for them to accomplish their wartime mission. That got them excited. That got my attention. And I fell in love. And after that, all I wanted to do was contract and fiscal law.
And sir, to piggyback on that, so can you explain for our listeners, how do contract and fiscal law interact with each other in our legal system?
In our legal system, when you think about, we talk contract and fiscal, some people will say acquisitions and appropriations and everything, but really it's all resources, right? It's all, how do we apply national resources to accomplish the wartime mission? That's how that, but both of those together, the fiscal law is the funding aspect, the contract law is the actually acquiring of that capability.
Sir, what are the essential skills and qualities just advocates need to succeed in contract and fiscal law?
So I would say attorneys that are going to be successful in the contract and fiscal field need two, maybe three core skills. The first is attention to detail, right? You need to really, there's a lot of rules depending on whether it's contract or fiscal, and the extent of those rules vary for each one. How restricted they are vary for each one. So you need a lot of attention to detail, right? And you need to be able to understand kind of the extent of those rules, the extent of restriction, or the extent of authorities. So that attention to detail is going to be very important. So that's the first thing I think that attorneys need. The second thing that I would say, and really the most important thing, and I would say for almost any attorney when they are in a legal advisory capacity, is understanding the role of the attorney, okay? So as attorneys, we are legal advisors. We are policy advisors. We are not decision makers. In the Army, in the Air Force, in DOD, it's usually commanders who are decision makers. But it doesn't need to be military commanders. It could be directors, SESs, you know, of directors of organizations. They're the decision makers. What I find, where I see a contract and fiscal attorney truly struggle a lot of times, is they are either don't understand that role, right, where they're trying to assume for themselves the role of the decision maker, or they refuse to accept that role, right? Either one of those two things. They don't understand the role, or they refuse to accept that role. And it really just comes down to trust. Do we trust that our agencies are selecting the right people to be the decision makers? And if you trust that, then you trust it. And you give all of the options to the commanders and decision makers, our clients, that they have, even if it's not something you think it's a good idea. As an attorney, you might not think it's a good idea. Not your call. That's the call of the commander. That's the call of the director, the decision maker. And that's a key attribute that I think is important. The third thing I would say is, once you understand all the rules, the science part of it, that's where the art, bringing the contract and the fiscal together, having the creativity to be able to find ways to be able to allow your commander, give them the, show them the legal way to do the things that they feel they need to do to be able to accomplish their mission. Now, does that mean that I'm advocating for breaking the law? No, absolutely not. But I will tell you that in my experience, 99% of the time, there might be a policy that is restrictive, but typically it's not necessarily the law that's being broken, right? And you have to distinguish between that policy advice that, oh, this doesn't violate the law. Here's the policy, maybe that does violate, but there's different reactions. There's different potential possibilities, right? If it's policy, we know we can get an exception to policy from whoever promulgated the policy. If your commander has enough support within the system, he'll be able to get to that exception to policy, right? That's different than trying to change the law. In the very few instances where the law is being broken, great, if you do it that way. Is there a way to get to what the commander's intent? What is the effect that the commander is trying to accomplish? So is there a way to get to that effect, even if not in the route that the commander or their staff has proposed, but a different route that doesn't violate the law? So try to use that creativity to find the ways to get there. So finally, in the very last moment, in my career, maybe 1% of the time is there truly a legal issue and it just cannot be done because it violates the law. If you've done those things and been use your knowledge and your power, superpower of contract and fiscal law knowledge to be able to get them the answers, you've then built the trust and you're going to be able to explain to them and they're going to accept that you're giving them the full advice that there's no way you can do that. But then that doesn't end. That commander wants to do that for a reason, even though the law tells them they can't. Every single time there is a legal no, in other words, it violates the law, violates the black and white of the law, there should be a legislative proposal that goes up from that unit up to change the law to allow that commander to do what they're wanting to do to accomplish their mission. So again, it's all understanding what our role is as attorney. We are legal advisors, we're enablers for the command, okay, but we're not the decision makers.
Sir, if somebody is interested in this area, how could someone pursue a role in contract and fiscal law?
So each of the services is different. So I'm going to focus on the Army here, right? Each of the services is different. If you're in the Navy, I would tell you, you can't be a JAG in the Navy and do contract and fiscal because that's all done at the civilian level, at the OGC level. The same thing for the Marines. Our sister service, the Air Force, they do contract and fiscal and everything, but it's a little bit different from us because they have more centralized platforms than we do. We power down a lot more authority down at lower levels sometimes in the Air Force, and but I'm gonna go ahead and focus on the Army side, right? So on the Army side, contract and fiscal law in our enterprise, we've got about 20 captain positions, we've got about 45 to 50 major positions, we've got about 25 to 30 lieutenant colonel positions, and we've got about 12 to 15 colonel positions. So based on that structure, if one of our captains gets a great opportunity to do contract law, that's great, but you're ahead of the power curve. The vast majority of contract and fiscal law kind of specialists, when we start specialize, really start at the major level post-grad course. Now, if you've never done a contract job as a captain, I would recommend in the Army, you want to specialize in contract and fiscal law in the grad course, so that you can start climbing the knowledge curve, and then we're gonna be able to get you a job as a major. Now, you have to do at least one contract fiscal job as a major, either as a major or as a captain, but before you get promoted lieutenant colonel. Once you get promoted lieutenant colonel, if you have not done a contract and fiscal job ever, we're not gonna be able to bring you in. Because just the scope of responsibility, the expectations of contract law knowledge, expertise and everything, that all shoots up lieutenant colonel and above for us. And you really have to have done at least one job to really have a reasonable chance to perform that job successfully as a lieutenant colonel, which is gonna be both a significant contract and fiscal law job and a significant leadership job as well. So that's we bring you in as majors. Now, and we can bring you in as majors. If you get a chance to be a captain, you're ahead of the power curve, but bring you typically in as majors, and you got to do at least one job as a major, and then you can build that expertise from there going forward. And I would argue that you want, so to be an expert in any of area of expertise, you have to have done that job, that type of job in that area of expertise, in that functional area, at least one job at each rank. After major for contracts, but for a lot of specialties, they even require some jobs as a captain to be able to really move on forward, going forward. So those are kind of how the way that our enterprise, contract fiscal enterprise works in the Army, kind of how it's structured. So I get a lot of captains sometimes, or a lot of, you know, brand new captains are coming out of the basic course, and they will ask me about that, and I'll tell them, hey, that's great, you have a lot of time to do that, to bring you in as a captain, but there are some things that are important for you to do first before you do a contract job. I always recommend you go first to division and corps and be a judge advocate at the division and corps level for a lot of different reasons. And once you do that, then you can do a contract job. But I would also say, and I always say, especially as captains, I always recommend for our captains to do a little bit of everything. And it's just because you don't know what you're going to love to do until you do it and get a chance to do it. Just like me, I thought I was going to be an MJ guy. I thought I was going to be Perry Mason. And maybe I'm dating myself by saying Perry Mason, and people don't understand that's a 1950s crime prosecutor show. But I thought I was going to, I did it, and it wasn't for me. And I wouldn't have, if I'd already been tracked and just tried to do all that, then, you know, I would have had a very different career, a very different life, and not had the opportunity to do contract and fiscal. And frankly, I would ask my young captains, how do you know you love contract if you haven't tried something else? So I would say, try to do a little bit of everything, and then go to the grad course, and then start specializing if you've decided you've wanted to stay within the contract and fiscal field and build that as an area of expertise.
Sir, what is one piece of advice you wish someone had given you when you were starting your career in contract and fiscal law?
Yeah. So, you know, I talked a little bit about the role, right? So when I so you know I like I said, as a captain, I got the opportunity to deploy, and I got the opportunity to do contract and fiscal law in a deployment setting. I came back from that, and then after that, I went to the grad course. After the grad course, I got the opportunity to stay and teach at ADK at the contract and fiscal law department at the U.S. Army JAG School. So and then it was not until after that I went to be the command judge advocate of the 411th Contract Support Brigade in Korea. So that was really my first full-on contract job, was the 411th CSB, as basically a senior major or second half or second tour major and everything. And I think that coming out of the, when you're in the JAG school, when you learn contracts in the JAG school like I did, you know, or really learn it deeply, right? You think about it as a bunch of different areas with a bunch of rules. Right. And I think when I first started operating as a CJA, my mindset was, well, what are they doing that breaks these rules? Right. So it was like I was Mr. No for a while. And I had my great mentor, Ralph Tramaglio. Right. At some point we had worked something together and he gave me a call. He was actually in Germany. And he gave me a call from Germany all the way to Korea. So it was important enough to do that. And what he said to me, I remember to this day, he said to me, hey, Jose, use your knowledge to empower the command, not to restrict what it can do, right? So that's what you need to do. And I gave that a lot of thought. And I tell you that probably changed my career, because after that, then I said, you're absolutely right. I have all this knowledge. How can we get the commander, enable the commander? And it really kind of caused a shift in my thinking about what my role was as a contract legal advisor and my role in enabling the commander, not in trying to find how the commander's wrong or the command's wrong or the command is doing something wrong. It's, hey, what are you trying to do? What's the commander's intent? What are you really trying to affect? What are you really trying to reach, the result? And then how can I use my knowledge in contract and fiscal to create, design the program that will help them get there?
Sir, with all of your experience that you have in this field, what do you think the future of contract and fiscal law looks like in the next 5 to 10 years? Are there any emerging trends that you think that we should be aware of?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sarah. The first thing has been happening, two big trends. Back before about 1980, right, we bought three things. We bought services, we bought supplies, and we bought construction, right? And in supplies, we bought kind of big weapon systems and everything else and all that. Since the 1980s, we've had kind of this explosion of computerization and software, okay? Software is not a good fit for a service or the system that we have with how we fund tanks, right? And how we fund, how we buy these things. Those big systems, maybe that traditional fiscal waterfall approach, right? Which is you go strict art, you do research and development, then test and evaluation. You finish that. Once that's done, now you procure it. You've developed it. You've tested it. Now you procure it. You send it to the field, and now you sustain it with O&M. That is not a good fit for software, right? Software is continually being updated. And the problem is that from a fiscal law perspective, the fiscal framework doesn't support, once you've got the software out into the field, to bring it back to do software updates. Even something as small as a software patch, some people would argue that technically that's coding, technically that's adding a new capability that never existed before, which is the very definition of RDT&E. But the problem is that once you've exited RDT&E into with that software, right, to get new RDT&E, you have to go back through the 3-year PPBE process, which is the program, planning, program, and budgeting execution process. So that's the fiscal process by which we go to Congress and ask for the funds. So it's just too slow. And it just does not allow for the flexibility that something like software, like an iterative approach, which is the way things, the software is created these days. So it's like you get your Microsoft patches and 365 or Office patches and everything else whenever there's a new vulnerability that's discovered. So I think that number one, the big thing is that's probably going to be our biggest challenge is going to be how do we modernize really the fiscal framework to provide the flexibility that these new kind of things like software provide. The second, so that's my first big thought. The second thought, I think that in the future it's really doubling down on that software, and it's AI, okay? So back in the 1950s, right, when we created a weapon system, we would develop a weapon system, we would, you know, create it, and suddenly it works. If it was for the Army, then we would send it up to DAOGC and OTJEC, who would do a weapons review. Okay, well, does this satisfy the law of armed conflict, or under what conditions does it not? Kind of restrict, you know, create policy to be able to maintain the use of that weapon system within the law of armed conflict. That is, cannot be done that way with AI. When you think about AI, you got to understand how AI are developed. Okay, first, you start with these algorithms that are coded in by the programmers. And these algorithms allow that AI to learn. And inside that AI, it's frankly a black box. Nobody knows really what the AI is quote unquote thinking or how it's making decisions. All we know is wrote these algorithms and everything. Now, we try to influence that thinking for the optimal results by doing learning, by machine learning. And we take this AI through a series of machine learning paces where we tell it we give them a test, whether it be a picture or whether it be a scenario, and based on their result, we say, yep, good job, or no, you got it wrong, based on our perspective, based on the result we wanted to see. So that's the machine learning. The problem is that you go through this whole process, if you don't have the law of armed conflict incorporated into that AI from the get-go, it's going to be too late by the time it's all done. You actually have to bring the law of armed conflict into the algorithm development, into the machine learning, and to be able to build it into these AI from the get-go. So who are these attorneys that are at the development stage? Typically in the Army JAG Corps, there's going to be attorneys. There's going to be contract and fiscal law attorneys. They're advising commands and advising organizations and programs on the proper, you know, contract and fiscal. So in the next 5 or 10 years, I think you're going to start seeing an explosion of more of the Army, and not only the Army, frankly, and all of DOD, asking our contract and fiscal law attorneys to know not only contract and fiscal, but to then know, especially the LOAC, bring that in, the NSL, into the development of these AI, both the algorithm development and also the machine learning. And that's going to be happening across the board. So that's a growth area. On the NSL side, okay, there are a number of jobs that are NSL oriented. For example, let's say cyber law, right? Oh, great, cyber law. But guess what? A lot of the cyber law is acquiring all these systems. Well, we're going to expect our NSL attorneys to start learning contract and fiscal law to actually be able to do their jobs effectively, right? And to be able to generate that result. So I think over the next 5, 10, 20, and 30 years, you're going to see an explosion and really a merging in many ways of the KFL community and the NSL community, because we both need each other to be able to accomplish our mission of providing great advice to the clients going forward. Both on the acquisition side, that are traditional acquisition, we're going to need to bring more NSL into those. So almost like a KFL NSL brain, national security law, kind of LOAC kind of brain with the contract and fiscal, and vice versa, the NSL brain adding kind of these acquisition and fiscal kind of areas of expertise to them so they can effectively do their job. I think that that's really the growth area of the future.
Colonel Cora, thank you very much for taking the time to share your valuable insights and knowledge with our listeners. Until next time, sir.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time, Danielle and Sarah.
Thank you for joining us today in this episode of The Far and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
We love to hear from our listeners. Please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn.
information can be found in the show notes from today's episode.
The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General's Corps, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense.